Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Stephanie Curtis, sitting in for Carrie Miller. It's 9:23. There's a long-running study out of Stanford called the Equality of Opportunity Project. They examine economics and demographic data to see who can still achieve the American dream, that dream of upward mobility that all Americans from all backgrounds can get the chance to learn and work and thrive and make more money than their parents. In their most recent study, they found that Native American and African American children have sharply lower rates of upward mobility. So if a child is born onto the lowest 20% of the American economic ladder, if they're white, they have a 10.6% chance of climbing to the top 20%. And if they're black, they have a 2.5% chance. So 1 in 10 of chance of climbing from poverty to wealth if you're white, 2.5% if you're African American. But the new study also found dramatic downward mobility in black populations. Here's a quote from the study. Black children born to parents in the top income quintile are almost as likely to fall to the bottom quintile as they are to remain in the top quintile. By contrast, white children born in the top quintile are nearly five times as likely to stay there as they are to fall to the bottom. I know it's a lot of numbers. But when they dug into the numbers more, they also found that this disparity is entirely driven by gaps between black boys and other children. African American girls do as well as white girls economically. It's the black boys who can't climb up the economic ladder. It's black boys who are born into wealth who have a 50% chance of falling into poverty. All right, there's a lot more in the study. I've got two experts here with me who are going to help us look at the study and answer your questions. Noelle Hurd is a psychology professor at the University of Virginia. Welcome, Noelle.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. And Derek Hamilton is an associate professor of economics and urban policy at the New School in New York. Hi, Derek.
Hi. I actually got a promotion not too long ago.
You're kidding me.
So it's not in your bio, but I'm not a half professor, as somebody mocked me on Twitter, but a full professor.
Congratulations, full professor Hamilton. That's great. All right. If you have a question for Derek or Noelle, I'd especially like to hear from African-American men and the parents of African-American boys. Give us a call. Our number is 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. We're talking about economic success and race in America. All right. There is a lot in that study, and I barely skimmed the surface. Noelle, why don't we start with you? What did you hear in the study, and what do you want people to know about it?
Yeah, I mean, to me, the biggest take home with this is that, and I think the way that the project is titled is perfect, because it really forces us to think about the ways in which race affects economic opportunity. And I think there has been a lot of deflecting previously with research trying to explain black-white gaps in achievement and in earnings by pointing to different experiences that they've had that may be more specific to the individual or deficits within the family. And I think what this study very clearly shows is that opportunities that are presented to folks for advanced education, for advanced earnings, really do have to do with race, and in this case also gender. And one of the things that I had commented when I was initially contacted about the findings was the ways in which we particularly pathologize black men and really make this pairing between being a black man and having a propensity towards criminality. And I think that's a thing that ends up harming men in many facets. In one, that would be the school setting, which obviously is a strong predictor of how far they're going to go academically. Another means how they're treated by the criminal justice system, whether there's hyper-surveillance, the extent to which men are harassed by the police, the extent to which they get involved, you know, arrested, how they're treated by that system once they get involved. And then those things have implications for employment discrimination. I think there's, one of the things that we're seeing just as a broader society is move from manufacturing industry. Those were jobs that were available to low-skilled, low-educated workers in the past, and now that's really moved to a retail sector. And so if we are assuming that black men are criminal in some way or have a propensity towards violence, we're going to be less likely to employ them in these retail settings. We don't want them to be the ones who are helping us with our purchases or helping us to make our food choices. And so I think those ramifications of villainizing black men or these notions of kind of super predators or a propensity toward violence have many negative consequences that then, to me, map on quite obviously to potential for future earnings.
So what you read into this is that society is particularly racist against black men.
Yes.
Great. Not great, but clear. Derek, what did you read into the study? What was new here that you found?
What was new? I mean, that's a harder question to answer. I think this study confirms a lot of what me and some of my colleagues that have been engaged in what we call stratification economics have known for a while, that independent of class, there are components of race that lead to differences in outcomes that are structural components that one might characterize as discrimination. But this study should be applauded because it vividly presents the depiction of how one's parental class status doesn't protect their offspring if they are black individuals. And they do so with administrative data, which is not so common. So it's extremely useful, but I think it also vividly points to the fact that we are not post-racial. There, I use that word again that people use all the time, that, you find that black people, regardless of income, regardless of education, if you compare them to whites, they typically have worse outcomes in terms of employment, twice the unemployment rate, regardless of education. And we haven't even talked about health implications. And this may work. This may relate to Professor Hurd's work as well, when we talk about mental health consequences associated with trying to overcome obstacles due to racial stigma, even if you are a high achiever and you have high levels of education or income that comparable to a white person with similar levels of education or income, overcoming those barriers might manifest in some mental health consequences, which is why you might observe that blacks with similar levels of education as whites have twice the hypertension rates, for example.
So it's not just about you don't make as much money. It affects your happiness, your pursuit of happiness.
Yeah. And again, the rhetoric around work hard, study hard, and then you can achieve the American dream. One, it's not completely accurate. It's demonstrating that hard work and education alone is not going to secure you a piece of the American dream. And then two, the other aspect that it indicates is that what are the consequences associated with this above normal effort to overcome your obstacles? And what I'm trying to allude to is that there are not only material consequences in terms of economic well-being, there are health consequences as well. When one asks the question, why do black women with a college degree have a higher infant mortality rate than white women who've dropped out of high school, one link that might drive that fact would be the fact that these highly educated black women have to overcome obstacles that less educated white women might not face, and it might manifest into some health outcomes. And I guess I'm rambling on, but let me also make one other quick point, and that is the gender finding in the study.
It's astonishing.
Again, I think Professor Hurd is spot on in pointing out that with an intersectional lens, the ways that gender and race interact are nuanced, and there are ways in which black boys and men are affected in ways that black women might not be as pronounced in terms of their impact. But on the other hand, I think that this study claims that there are no impacts of structural racism, and maybe I'm overreaching in stating their claims on black women, is not quite accurate. I mean, in the graph that they depict, that it's true. It's hard to argue with the statistics they present. But maybe the comparison point of white women is not the accurate counterfactual for black women. It's not as if women operate in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. There are men in our society. So should white women be the right comparison for black women? I would say maybe not. And I'd say maybe not, not only because women don't operate in a vacuum in our society, but when one considers motivations to work, when one considers reasons of why one might have to work and achieve, the situation of black women is not the same as white women. For instance, if you have a husband that's present that makes a whole lot of money, that might influence the motivations to work for pecuniary reasons differently than if you have a husband that's incarcerated. So viewing women or men in isolation without a family context doesn't tell the complete story. And I think the isolation of black women in comparison to white women also downplays to some extent the role of both gender and race as it impacts black women's lives.
We have got to get to some phone calls here because we've got a few of them lined up and people want to ask you guys some questions. The phone number is 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Let's go to Jamunde in Minneapolis. Hi, what's your question?
Hey, morning. My question, over the years, like during my generation, and when I do read articles from way back when, 4 or 3 decades ago, it seems like when it comes to black men and black boys, we're always reminded of our shortcomings, of our ineptitude, of how, in comparison to white accomplishments, we fall short. And I guess I'm wondering, why is it always juxtaposed to white Americans? Why not Hispanic? Why not Asian? And does it, in a way, do us a disservice, especially for young boys, to consistently be reminded of their future, pretty much, of how bleak it looks?
All right. Thank you very much for calling in. And one interesting thing about this study, well, a lot of interesting things, is that it did compare how African Americans did compared to Asian Americans and Hispanic Americans. And Noelle, what did you learn?
Yeah, so I was going to say that as well. I mean, I think this is a great question from the caller, and I think about this a lot, too, as well as a parent, thinking about what kind of messages to instill in my child. And I think one thing to know is that, you know, and as a researcher, we really do need to continue to highlight disparities. We need to kind of show the ways in which opportunity is not equal within this country. It was never designed to be, and we're still, you know, kind of contributing to those exact same problems today. So I think these comparisons, and in particular, as you alluded to, the finding that this is an issue, particularly for black Americans, black men in particular are probably driving that, and then American Indians, and we're not seeing the same for Hispanics and Asians. And I think those points of comparison are useful, right, in mm-hmm. terms of making sure that we're understanding where in particular are we as a society disadvantaging folks and not extending the same opportunities. So as a researcher, there's a part of me that feels like, you know, someone who's done research on discrimination, one who's, you know, very familiar with the research that we were talking about earlier in the segment about the ways in which discrimination gets under the skin and affects those physical and mental health outcomes. And so I think those are very important things to document, because if we're not raising awareness of those problems, then I don't know how we'll get any kind of societal response that will help us to change the things that we're doing that are so oppressive and problematic. At the same time, I think about how do we talk to children? You know, is there a way in which these kinds of conversations may come across as, you know, communicating some kind of deficit or inadequacy? And so I think it's so important to have these conversations while talking about structural oppression, while talking about what might be driving these findings, as opposed to, you know, well, there's these black-white differences and, hey, you know, they've always been there, and not talking about that in the context of, you know, slavery, for example, Jim Crow segregation, you know, convict labor. I mean, if we're not teaching all of our children, not just black boys, teaching all of our children about the very specific ways in which our society was designed to oppress black Americans in particular, as well as Native Americans and other groups, then we're doing a disservice to all of our children. And if we're not thinking about the ways in which we're continuing to contribute to oppressive practices, then I don't know how we'll ever get a grasp on how to address them honestly and then change them if we're not even willing to face them. At the same time, I think, you know, it does have to be a conversation with young people about, given that these are, you know, the ways in which our society is designed, what can we be doing to change that? You know, all of us are responsible for advocating for that. And I do have some colleagues who do work around, the construct is called critical consciousness. And the idea is really raising awareness among marginalized groups of their very marginalization, right? Of kind of talking about what is it that society has done historically and currently to oppress, and what are the ways in which we can get involved with activism, get involved with advocacy to change that. And I think there has been research to suggest that for especially members of marginalized groups who are active in those domains, that can in and of itself promote better outcomes for young people. So I think it is not, you know, trying to push the conversation away or kind of sweep it under the rug, but having it in a really honest way with all of the facts present, making sure that children aren't kind of given that information and left to their own devices to try and understand what might be driving those disparities. Because you don't want young people to start assuming, well, it's because of some kind of individual or biological deficit across racial or ethnic groups. There's been nothing to support that. And so it's really about kind of documenting the ways in which society is structured and then thinking about from a, you know, real constructive problem-solving way, what is it that we can do? If not, I do think there's a way in which you can feel overwhelmed and kind of helpless. And so I think we do have to kind of keep the conversation focused on societal structures and how we can think about changing those.
Let's go to the phones now. Oh, Derek, you wanted to say something right now?
Yeah, I'll try to be brief. I think the caller is spot on in that we approach inequality, particularly with regards to black boys and black males, from a deficit perspective. We have rhetoric around trying to incentivize their defective behavior so that they can be more employable. That becomes part of the rhetoric. What can we do to change their behavior? And that's problematic, and I think that this study helps to dispel that narrative. Even when we look at high achievers, black males from so-called good families that have high levels of resources, we still see this trajectory of downward mobility. In fact, if we look at highly educated black boys and black men, we still see that they have, relative to their white peers, worse outcomes. The point about incarceration, that black youth from high levels of wealth, their wealth doesn't protect them from incarceration the same way it does white individuals. I think it kind of dispels this deficit narrative and turns more towards a structural narrative of why there's inequities that and perhaps will move us away from solutions that are, again, trying to address the incentives of black people, but rather trying to create a structural so that black people have the resources, agency, and free of discriminatory barriers to get rid of the marginalization in the first place. That would be a better approach. And then I wanted to say a couple of things about the comparisons to Asians and Hispanics.
Yeah.
One, we need to disaggregate these groups. Work that I'm doing with William Darity and a team of researchers called the National Asset Scorecard for Communities of Color, we find that when you disaggregate some Latinos and Asian groups, for instance, Koreans that reside in Los Angeles, their net wealth position is about 20-some-odd thousand dollars, whereas Koreans who reside in Washington, D.C., their net wealth position is over $200,000. We're finding that in this study. But even in the L.A. context, Koreans in L.A. have a much lower wealth position than those with Japanese heritage. So why am I pointing this out? I'm pointing this out that this notion of Asian, Latino as a collective entity ignores some of the nuances that come along with immigration and the status by which they migrated. So in other words, if you came to the United States from Cambodia or Vietnam as more of a refugee in refugee status, your net wealth position and that of your descendants is not going to be the same as that who might have migrated for more economic reasons and may have been here longer, such as those with Japanese heritage, for example. So it also gets to this notion of people rely on demography as, well, America will be a majority minority in year 20, blah, blah, blah. I think it's 2050 is the current date that's put forth. Well, demography alone will not save us. And it will not save us because the definition of what the in-group is, what whiteness is, that's something that's fluid. It's not something that's static throughout time. That changes. What we ultimately need to do, and again, Professor Hurd hit on this as well, we need to come up with policies and structures that really get rid of marginalization altogether. And we have those solutions that problems are not economic, but rather political, so that we can have an inclusive society.
All right, let's go to the phone calls, because I think that Ricky will ask the question that we need to hear next. Hey,
how
Ricky.
How you doing?
Good. You're calling from Northfield.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I was wanting to ask, in general, but also specifically to the male professor, he did on just now in one of his replies. Looking at that, my partner and I, we've done pretty well, married, education, jobs and such. But three young kids, two girls, one boy. And so the question comes to play with that young African-American male. We've been in places I know in the country where I've been told by older African-Americans, this is not a place you want to raise a black boy at for various reasons. Black girls do fine in this area. Black boys won't. And so looking at either characteristics, motivations, and or qualities we can kind of like hone in our children, especially our young men, also looking at policies that can help push back that marginalization, what is going on in that avenue? So kind of looking at twofold.
Yeah, the personal and the structural. Yeah, structural.
Yeah.
How old is your son, Ricky?
Big man. Nicholas is 10.
All right.
Fourth grade.
Good. Thanks for calling. And so Northfield is a college town in rural Minnesota, and of course, we're in Minnesota. So, Noel, what advice would you give to Ricky personally, and what do both of you give? And then we'll move on to the bigger structural question that Ricky had.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've had a lot of friends kind of reaching out asking similar kinds of questions, like, what can I do in particular to protect my son, you know, in the context of these findings. And I think that the problem is that we, especially as parents, want to think about things that we can do individually. And I think this ties into the earlier comment about this notion that there's something that, you know, it's choices, right,
mm-hmm.
or it's values. And I think the answer here, and I know that this may be not exactly what the caller is looking for, is that it's much likely less about any specific thing. It sounds like you're doing all the things you need to do as a parent. And, you know, I think we go down the wrong path when we start thinking that there's things that we as individuals, as parents or as our children can be doing to fight structural racism, like, you know, behaving a certain kind of way or, you know, engaging in a certain type of way with the police or, you know, because this is much bigger, right, than a one-to-one type of situation. It's not about, you know, one racist cop. It's about a broader criminal justice system that is at its core racist, right, designed specifically to target black men. And so I think we want to think about collective action, especially those of us who have been fortunate enough to achieve, you know, middle class or upper middle class status. We have to lose, you know, this illusion that we've somehow escaped these problems, because these are problems that primarily affect lower-income Americans, especially communities of color. And so we want to think more about the ways in which collectively, as a society, we can address these inequalities, because the consequences, there is this ripple effect, right? And the extent to which black criminality, especially black male criminality, is a kind of constant and an image that we all consume in the media, that will continue to affect black men across the income spectrum. And so the ways in which our teachers are engaging with our children, the ways in which opportunities are provided or not provided, and especially in the employment sector, whether someone's hired or not, even as a teenager, whether or not they can get their first job and start to get acclimated to the world of work, and then that opens up opportunities for future employment. So I think the answer really is that we need to become more informed about the injustices that are affecting the broader community, and think about ways in which we can join in and leverage, especially if we do have any kind of human capital, if we have financial capital, the ways in which we can invest that and invest our energies in tackling a really problematic system.
I wanted to give a concrete example of ways that children are identified early as problems. Former Minneapolis school superintendent Bernadina Johnson was quoted in the New York Times this week. She said that descriptions of white children by teachers, and these were kindergartners, included, quote, gifted but can't use his words, and high strung, or their actions were excused because they had a hard day. And black children were described, and these were 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds, as destructive, violent, and cannot be managed. How do we change that as a society? How do we change structural racism that starts with you looking at a 5-year-old and thinking that he's violent? Derek?
I mean, one thing I would say quickly is just that I teach a class on structural determinants of inequality. And in that class, we talk a whole lot about racism. And this is a graduate seminar. And my students are amazing, but they are so frustrated and disappointed that they are just now in their, you know, early 20s accessing this information. And it's so inconsistent with the way that they've been taught. Their entire K through 12 and even 4 years of college education has omitted all of this information. And we teach children a lot of history, and I think we do it in a very dishonest way. And then these are the same people who grow up to be these teachers and politicians and, you know, leaders of our country. And so for me, one of the core, you know, and as an educator, I guess I'm biased, but one of the core things that we need to start doing to really truly address our country's problem with racism is to honestly teach our children about the history of this country and the way that it is continuing to be designed to marginalize and oppress individuals, you know, for the specific profit of others. And that's how it's been designed, and that's the way that it continues to be maintained.
Neil is on the line from St. Paul, and I think he's going to ask a question that will lead directly into your answering what you want to say, Derek. Let's go to Neil and let him get a chance to talk. Hi, Neil. You've been waiting, and I want to hear from you.
Yes. Boy, there's a whole lot of stuff here. But at the same time, everybody's heard the notion that we're overstudied. This is just way too much. So I like to go to solutions always now at my age of 55. I've heard all these studies over the last 30 years, et cetera. Now, me, my brother's a retired cop. My younger brother has his PhD in mathematics. I'm an ex-sergeant, ex-loan officer, ex-probation officer. So I've seen the criminal justice system inside and out. Now, we're only talking 1 to 2 million black males throughout the country out of 40 to 50 million of us. So I'm like, where do we study those people at? Now back to the school system. Yes, obviously we need more black male teachers. Okay, people have been saying that for decades as well. So where's the study as to the progress of that? Okay, that would be an answer, especially dealing with the divorce rate since 1968, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And we're dealing with all these dysfunctional situations and so on. So unfortunately, in this country, the school system has been a dumping ground for white, black, and green children that come out of divorces, et cetera. And so therefore, we have to somewhat, in terms of solutions and fixing things, like I said, I'm back to the teacher. Where's the study on the progress of getting more black male teachers that represent a cross-section of disciplines?
Okay, thank you, Neil. Neil had he's overwhelmed like we all are with all the information and wants to know, one about African-American male teachers and role models and what kind of a difference that would make. What did the study tell us about African-American male role models?
So let me also respond to your question about hostility within integrated environments. Mm-hmm. I think your question, as well as the caller's question, points to this notion that, in my view, integration is not the panacea. If you're integrating schools or you're integrating neighborhoods, some people propose we need integrated schools, we need integrated neighborhoods. Integration into hostility is certainly not necessarily a good thing. If we have apartheid-like schools where all the high-achieving classes are white and all the low-achieving classes are black, or we have neighborhoods where neighbors aren't willing to share with their other neighbors, simply putting a black person in a white neighborhood doesn't necessarily mean that that black person will benefit from some of the resources in that neighborhood if the neighbors aren't willing to share. It also addressed this notion of, is there something inherently wrong with black people having schools that are populated by other black people or neighborhoods that are populated by other black people? The answer I say is there's nothing culturally wrong about that, but rather it might be that those schools and those neighborhoods have low resources to begin with. So If the issue is resources, then that's what needs to be addressed. So in schools, if we need to come up with mechanisms so that every child has access to the high-achieving curriculum with teachers that are sympathetic to the cultural heritage that the students come from, as well as trained with the sensitivity to deliver that high-achieving curriculum. So things like tracking within schools, well, that detracts from this mission. We need to have not only if we want to have integrated schools, what we really need is integrated curriculum where every child is exposed to high-achieving curriculum. And similarly, with regards to neighborhood, this study alluded a lot about neighborhoods in which people come from. Well, if we just think about neighborhoods, that leaves open two types of mechanisms of what might be driving different outcomes. Again, is there something about Black people living next to other Black people that makes them worse off? No, that becomes just a pejorative narrative. What the issue is resources. Everybody should have access to high-quality policing, high-quality schooling. And by high-quality policing, I certainly don't mean over-policing where we stop and harass people all the time, but tolerable security so that people can operate in neighborhoods without the fear of crime. And everybody would want that. And again, I certainly don't want to give the message of we need things like stop and frisk where we make people weary and vulnerable simply to just walk in their neighborhoods because of their race and gender.
Let's go to the phone. CJ in Bloomington is waiting. Hi, CJ.
Hey, how are you doing? Thank you for letting me get in on
You're
this.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I'm from Chicago, and I've been living here in Minnesota for 32 years, okay? And my thing is about the history of this country. When I moved here from Chicago, I didn't even know that the Native Americans even existed. You know, according to the way things were taught to us in school, I'm looking for the feathers in the paint. You know, and it was like when I started to be friends with them and started hearing their issues, to this day, they don't even get the respect at all. And I mean, Black people is complaining a lot about a lot of things, which they got a right to do so. But the Native Americans, their voices has been so silent that they don't even. It's like, wow, if you're not going to fix the way the history is really taught, that does have a lot to do with the way people are perceived. Don't you think?
Yeah, thanks, CJ. Noel, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's exactly related to what I said earlier about how we are just completely dishonest in the way that we teach about the history of this country and who our heroes are. And that ties into Derek's earlier points, I think, about just it's about teaching about the honest history of oppression, and it's also about teaching about who are our leaders and heroes from history, and those are not all white men. In fact, a lot of the white men that we hold up and put on these pedestals are actually the biggest monsters of our history. So I think that's a, you know, part of it is, you know, how could we be teaching in a way, teaching a very rigorous curriculum that's engaging for all students. And I think it's very disengaging for students from these various groups who have been oppressed historically and currently to hear about a very whitewashed version of history that doesn't acknowledge the contributions, that doesn't acknowledge the struggles and oppressions that their group faced. And so I think that's a central part of it. And also just to agree with what Derek was saying earlier that, you know, the finding in this study about, you know, Black boys who are attending the same schools and living in the same neighborhoods, it is important to understand that being in the same school and being in the same neighborhood does not guarantee the same experiences. And so we do have schools that are diverse in terms of enrollment, but if you go in that school and you realize that all of the AP classes are exclusively white students and all of the special ed classes are exclusively Black students, especially Black male students, that's a school-level problem. And if people are not seeing that and wondering how could that possibly be happening or expect that students are in any way having the same experience in that school, that is not an example of diversity working. It's not just about putting a bunch of different people in a room together and hoping for the best. And so I think we have a long ways to go in our education system in many ways and how we're teaching and what our curriculum is and the ways in which we're getting rid of things like tracking that serve to just reify and kind of maintain these gaps that we've had all along.
I have to say goodbye to you both, and I wish we didn't because I have so many more questions. We've got lots of callers waiting, too, but thank you both. Derek Hamilton is a full professor, non-assistant professor of economics and urban policy at the New School in New York, and Noel Hurd is an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thanks
thank you. I enjoyed the conversation.